We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. This morning we're going to talk about Christmases past in Illinois. We'll hear about a letter home from a Civil War soldier, a look at Christmas 1898 in Champaign, a much-loved column from Chicago columnist Mike Royko, letters to Santa, and cookie recipes. These things and more are to be found in the book Christmas in Illinois. Christmas in Illinois is a collection of holiday memories, recipes, and images. There are stories here that are merry, certainly, but there are also stories of mischief and heartbreak. And the stories come from every part of the state, north to south, east to west. Our guest is the book's editor, James Ballou. Listeners, you can join us this morning with your stories of Christmas past. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. James Ballou is a professor emeritus of English at Bradley University. The book, Christmas in Illinois, is published by the University of Illinois Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu is the email address. James Ballou, good to talk with you again. How are you?
Well, it's a pleasure being here this morning.
How are things where you are today?
It's a little bit foggy and quite a bit snowy. Warming up.
Yeah, so, well, we've got quite a bit of snow here in Champaign-Urbana as well.
It's Christmas.
That's right. It looks like Christmas. It feels like Christmas. Could we begin, though, with the story of the Civil War soldier that I mentioned in my introduction and his letter home at Christmas, 1863. This is on pages 17 and 18. The letter writer was from Greenville, and his name was John B. Reed. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he was a one of the conscripted leaders of an officer in the Civil War, and he was his infantry company was down in Matagorda, Texas, and they were getting ready to go northward to squeeze the Confederate Army. Just before Christmas, he wrote this lovely letter to his wife and children. And it's sort of significant that it was in 1863 because that was about the time that people began really thinking about Christmas as something that should be observed. And I think the Civil War helped bring that, helped focus on that.
Yeah, and it was President Grant who made it a federal holiday.
About 7 years later, yes,
yeah.
In 1870. Of course, he signed the proclamation, as presidents do, and forever will be the person who made Christmas a federal holiday in the United States.
Yeah. Perhaps you would read, do you have the book there and have it open?
I do indeed.
Would you read the opening of this letter? It's quite charming, and maybe then we can talk a little bit more about the contents of the letter.
I will indeed. Duke Crow's Point, Matagorda, Texas, December 25th, 1863. Dear wife and children, I wish you all a Merry Christmas. As for myself, I have spent as pleasant a day as could be expected. The day proved to be warm and pleasant, and a great number of the men went bathing. I did not indulge myself, but those that did said the water was very comfortably warm, and the salt water seemed to give them all fine appetites for the enjoyment of their hardtack, coffee, and mutton. After our dress parade, which was our only duty of the morning, I, in company with a few more officers, went on board a ship to a splendid dinner. We had soup, baked fish, turkey, pudding pie, nuts, and raisins. It was indeed a treat to us all, and served as only a first-class steamboat cook can serve.
Mm-hmm.
I trust that you and the dear ones have enjoyed the day, and it would have been much more pleasant to have been with you. But God orders it otherwise. I will go on here a little bit. I hope the sheets of small currency reached you in time for this day, as the children should see that Father did not forget them while so far away. I suppose Mr. Murdoch was with his happy family for their Christmas dinner, and I know it must have been a great comfort to them to have him there after so long an absence.
Mm-hmm.
I think this, as this goes on, it explains the difficulty of war, although the officers did get a fine Christmas dinner out on a ship off the coast of Matagorda. And it's interesting that John Reed returned home to southern Illinois, to his home in Greenville, and that he, in Bond County, and that he died on Christmas Day in 1912. So this is, I thought this was a fitting sort of reminder of how Christmas takes us apart from one another during times of war. Of course, World War II, it did that in particular. And in our memory and the other subsequent police actions and wars that we have had.
Yeah. So this is a bittersweet letter, I would say. In one sense, he's trying to comfort his wife and children and tell them that he is okay and that he misses them. But indeed, this is being a way to fight a war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I wondered at least one incident of that, and many, many people throughout the state could have sent stories, or did send some stories. This one I thought was representative. It's a reflective piece because he is not yet in battle, and those letters that were written during times of battle, of course, are perhaps more heart-wrenching than this would be.
Yeah. And thank goodness that someone preserved these letters.
Yes. This is one of the one of the items that was called up by a person from an archive, a genealogist well-known by the name of Kevin Kagi. He heard that I was doing this this book and submitted the letter. He had written an introduction to it in the local paper, and I think that these things, these historical documents are of extreme importance to be able to keep, these written, handwritten documents. And I just hope we find some way of doing that during an era of electronic correspondence.
Yeah. Well, John Reed wrote his wife and children about having some comforts and hoping that they had enjoyed the day. And so we have some feasting and some reflection on the day. And these are common themes in many of the stories in Christmas in Illinois. Were there any regional differences in how Illinoisans marked Christmas 100, 150 years ago?
Well, there were regional differences. Most of the differences that I point out in the book are chronological. That is how people 100 years ago celebrated Christmas as compared to today. But I think both of those things, chronological and his historical, that is, cultural, go along in tandem. The reason being that this state was pretty much founded in the southern part, not the northern part of the state. And Shawneetown and the smaller towns were places where frontiersmen came and established residences. And, of course, the French and the Spanish held areas of the state and of Missouri across the river. And then the British came in, and then, of course, the Americans or the frontiersmen from the colonies came in. And this was this caused Christmas to be quite different in various places. The French, the Germans, and Teutopolis is one of the towns that Germans settled early on, celebrated Christmas because many of them were Catholic. And those of Anglo-Saxon descent did not celebrate Christmas, partially because for the first century or so of the founding of this country, from the early 17th century on, the founding of the colonies, the Puritans rejected paganism, and they rejected, of course, anything that had to do with the Catholic Church. So Christmas was not celebrated as a religious ceremony. Quite often people went out, and adults went out, and I think this is important, that adults were the center of the Christmas celebration, and they let off steam by drinking too much, and they performed hijinks, and they did trick-or-treating, which perhaps they borrowed from the Halloween celebrations. Particularly the less wealthy would trick or treat the more wealthy, and that became sort of the hijinks were sort of the way that Christmas was celebrated. For the more domestic, it might have been sleigh rides, it might have been just going, being outside, celebrating the solstice as much as Christmas Day. But religious, particularly the Protestant religious celebrations and observances of Christmas, slowly came into the United States and, of course, into the state of Illinois in 1818, when the state became a state. It slowly, through the period of the 19th century, became a spiritual celebration for many people and a domestic celebration, particularly because of Victoria, because of much of the literature that had begun to be developed in America, Washington Irving's Knickerbocker Tales, Charles Clement Moore's 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. These are these began to be embedded in the American conscience, and children became the cynosure of Christmas, not the adults, and not the spreeing, that is, the partying that went on in the earlier frontier.
Yeah, there's some stories in the book where people are, young men are just out of control. And I read some of these thinking, I would hate to have someone like one of these individuals come to the door, you know, when we're sitting down for a Christmas dinner, whatever that Christmas dinner might compose of. And I guess often it was game, but what a mess.
Yes, and it was game indeed. And there's a story as well that John Allen, Southern Illinois historian, writes of Audubon, actually quotes from his diaries about the about Audubon stopping, I believe, in 1810, the Cache River down near the Ohio River, and staying with some Shawnee Indians. They go hunting together on Christmas Day across the Ohio River into Kentucky, and they kill all these beautiful swans. And he gives a rather startling description of how the swans are dying in the water. That was not unheard of. I mean, that was typical. People went out and instead of doing bird counts, they did bird killing. Well, they didn't have photographs, and Audubon was, you know, our great chronicler of what birds were in the Midwest, and particularly in southern Illinois, and he had to kill them. But he went out with not only with ammunition, as he says, but with a good supply of whiskey, which we would say is an absolute no-no as far as hunting is concerned today.
Yeah. This is Focus. Our guest this morning is James Ballou. He is the editor of Christmas in Illinois. It's a collection of holiday memories, recipes, and images. There are stories here that are merry, certainly, but there are also stories of mischief, as we've been talking about just now, and heartbreak. And these stories come to us from every part of the state, north to south, east to west. And the very first story comes to us from the year 1700, and the book contains Christmas stories up until the present day. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, before we get off the spree theme of Christmas, I just wanted to read an excerpt, if it would be okay with you, from Skins as a Circulating Medium.
Oh, please do.
This is a piece that was originally penned by R.O. White, and I'll dip right into it. A story is told of a party of fellows on a Christmas spree who, finding themselves about out of whiskey and not having the wherewithal to replenish, hit upon the following expedient to obtain a supply. They went out one night to a little grocery, having one raccoon skin with them. This paid for whiskey enough to furnish them all a drink or two around, including the proprietor, who, of course, was fond of the article and imbibed rather freely, soon becoming hilarious from its effects. The party observed this, and each one, on placing the liquor to his lips, merely tasted it. But the grocery keeper, whenever it came his turn, took a good drink. Consequently, objects soon began to assume a confused appearance to his vision. This was just what they wanted, and getting him about right, as they expressed it, one of them slipped back to where the pile of skins lay, took one, and put it through a large crack in the wall of the hut, to the outside, then going out at the door, he went round, took up the skin, and after waiting a few minutes, came in, being saluted by the others as a fresh arrival, and presented his raccoon skin in payment for a certain amount of whiskey. That's one of the spree stories that gave me a good chuckle.
Yes. They're real. But they sound like tall tales today. Still, they tell us a great deal about the rough and tumble frontier that Illinois still was, even in the 1840s and 50s.
Hmm. Now, when I was a kid growing up in the 60s, it was a big deal to go to Chicago and walk down State Street at Christmas time. When did the retailers of Chicago begin to dress up State Street for Christmas?
Well, State Street, of course, was the central street in Chicago, probably maybe even before 1871, the Great Fire, but certainly afterwards when Potter Palmer put his new hotel across the street from where it had been previously and where it remains today. And also Marshall Fields had begun to sell to do retailing there on that street. The State Street Businessmen's Association always tended to make Christmas an important aspect of their sales, and as we know today, Christmas retail sales amount to a large percentage of the entire year's sales. But they did it in good spirit, and they wanted it to be not only, as they say on their sign in the book, a place where Christmas is where goodwill is distributed, but also goods are distributed with the goodwill. And I noticed that these photographs that I got in the from the Chicago Library, the Harold Washington Library, had just been given to them by the State Street Businessmen's Association. And the State Street is really represents Christmas, I think, in Chicago. One of the earliest photographs is that one of the sign that says "Building Goodwill," and it's the greatest collection of stores or something like
biggest
that.
Biggest street of stores in creation.
Thank you. I don't have the page.
Yeah. Well, I just happened to get lucky and open the book to it.
The biggest street of stores in creation. Now, we have the Magnificent Mile today, but for some reason, maybe it's age, I'm not quite sure, but there's a tendency to think of Marshall Field's windows on State Street, and that State Street is the center of Christmas. That first sign that I use in the book is dated about 1941. Well, it's interesting that Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1833 was contemplating, and he and his cabinet were contemplating declaring Thanksgiving as the date to be that Thanksgiving would be celebrated would be the fourth Thursday in November, not the last Thursday as it had been since Abraham Lincoln said the last Thursday November will be celebrated. Reason being, the Great Depression was they were bringing out all the stops trying to fight against the Great Depression, but it wasn't until about 1939, I believe, that proclamation was made that Thanksgiving will indeed be on the fourth Thursday. Now, what this did for the economy was to create an extra week to assure an extra week always for the commercial success of retail sales for Christmas. Christmas shopping begins on what we now know as Black Friday, which also has many meanings. But today it means we get out of the red and we get into the black for commercial enterprises.
Yeah.
And so that those pictures of the State Street coincide pretty much with that proclamation that the fourth Thursday will be Thanksgiving, and there will be more time to shop, and we will have be able to go after that Thursday and do a great deal of our Christmas shopping. Now we know it has become a rush on the stores, and it is even has a name, Black Friday. But it did assure that there would be many more days for shopping.
Yeah. Also, at this time, at this point in time, we have the emphasis on children, and we know, come 1950, following the war, there is a baby boom. So these things also, it seems to me, came together to boost Christmas and the commercialization of Christmas.
Oh, very, very much so. And if one thinks about it, the Christmas songs that we hold dear today during the war, during World War II, came into being. White Christmas, 1942. Shortly after the war, the Christmas song that Nat King Cole recorded, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in 1949, which was written for a Montgomery Ward's promotion,
mm-hmm.
Frosty the Snowman, 1950, Silver Bells, 1951. These are, of course, not sacred songs, but they're pretty much commercial in their lyrics, and we think of them as secular, but they are commercial.
This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about Christmases past in Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest is James Ballou. He is the editor of the new book, Christmas in Illinois, which is published by the University of Illinois Press. We invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments, your stories of Christmases past in Illinois, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also join us by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's go from maybe from commercialization to rather an romantic view of Christmas. And I liked this piece. This is called After Christmas. You call this piece After Christmas, and it comes from the Champaign County Gazette, a newspaper in Champaign County. 1898 is the year, and it's on page 28. And it's just a lovely quiet piece. It begins, "Not the least incident occurred to mar the merriment of Christmas in Champaign, and the general verdict is that years have not brought out a more enjoyable and perfect Christmas day. It looked for a time as though there was to be a green Christmas, which would be followed by a full graveyard, as the old-timers say. But when Santa Claus had completed his mission and was speeding away, there came in his tracks a snowstorm from the north. It was one of those good old snowstorms which add so much to the Christmas cheer, and when children and grown people, too, looked from the window Sunday morning, they were delighted, for snow adds everything to Christmas time." And here in this piece, you've included a photograph of the McCollum home in Champaign from 1950, and there's been a big snow.
Oh, yes. A little bit more than even what we have here today.
Yes, yes. And I suppose in 1898, if they had a big snow, you just sat it out. You weren't worrying about catching a plane for sure, or climbing in your car and taking off somewhere.
Well, it allowed you to go on a sleigh ride.
There you go.
Some of the earliest songs written by Americans were the song Sleigh Ride in 1848 or Jingle Bells in 1857. There were very few religious songs written prior to the Civil War by Americans related to Christmas,
yeah.
Using Christmas as a subject. So there, people were out doing things outside.
Yeah. "The customary Christmas quiet prevailed Sunday. The whole city was up unusually early, for everybody had to see what Santa Claus had brought, and the remainder of the day was devoted to trying on neckties, playing with jumping jacks, and eating turkey. In all the churches, there were special Christmas services, and they're, without an exception, well attended. When night settled over the city, the inhabitants, both young and old, were tired out and willing to retire without much effort. The desk reports at the police station Tuesday showed that men addicted to strong drink had gone about their habit with moderation through respect for the good day, and only one man was hauled in during the day on the charge of intoxication. His Christmas present was one of unusual size, Unfortunately, he could not handle it, and he had to pay $3 and costs for the privilege of getting someone else to handle it. All told, it was a Christmas holiday which had made the people feel happy and glad that they were alive, and nothing more could have been expected of it. When it did this, it had fulfilled its mission.
Yes, and this article by a reporter from the County News Gazette, County Gazette, tells us it's a transition piece into the more domesticated, from the spring, from the mischief period of celebration, to the more domesticated and child-centered Christmases, quiet and peace.
When we come across books about Christmas, they are, by and large, very cheery things. You've taken a different approach. Here there are all manner of stories. What led you in that direction?
Well, I grew up during the Depression and was a young child in the Depression and World War II. I think I was 12 when World War II ended. And those were years where, of course, we didn't dwell on the grim 24 hours a day. The grimness of life was nevertheless very quite present. And there were examples of it, news stories about it everywhere. Christmas tended, even in those families, I think, that had soldiers fighting in the Pacific or in Europe, or that had suffered and were still suffering from the Depression. Christmas was a time when you could almost feel a togetherness, period of quietness, but you never lost sight of the fact that at Christmas time there were people who were even worse off than you were, and there were people who were absent that you cared about.
Mm.
And I think that that period of time created an intensity of togetherness that no other period has done.
Yeah, I'm reminded now of the song, which probably comes from the 40s, but Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Yes, absolutely.
Next year will be better.
Right, and of course, this year we have certainly a great number of citizens in the state that are suffering some of the effects that we did during the Great Depression.
Mm.
And also in 1951, there was, in my hometown, and my friend Robert Coover has written a novel about this, The Origin of the Brunus, a mine disaster that killed 119 people. This happened to be in West Frankfort. And that kind of trauma to a number of communities, West Frankfort, Benton, Marion, Heron, Murfreesboro, Harrisburg, Carbondale. This was a terrible, terrible time. The mine disaster happened in 1921, and I'm sorry, on the 21st of in 1951, the 21st of December. Even on Christmas Day, miners were still being buried, and this created a different way of looking at the holiday. And the piece that I have in the book, that I included in the book, is by a young man who was my age at that time, 17 or so, and in the rest of his life, he was a coal miner. He went down deep in the mine, but he never forgot at Christmas time that experience of the community.
Yeah, and I think you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, over 100 men died in that Orient No. 2 mine explosion.
Right, 119.
119. And I'm now looking at this article, and I recall, let me turn the page here to where McReynolds wrote, in later years when I started my career in the coal mines, if I was working on December 21st, I would always say to my fellow miners, boys, this is the day Orient Number 2 blew up. Let's be extra careful today.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, these are small communities, and I would imagine that these mining disasters are still recalled today.
Right. And I don't want to give the impression that the book is filled with spring or grim thoughts.
No.
There's a great deal of joy and joyous memories in this this book, and traditions and songs and even eating
yeah.
merrily, as we
yes.
titled the section.
Eating merrily. When you were a youngster, what did you look forward to feasting on when you were a kid and times were a little tough? And what was your family's kitchen like at this time of year?
Well, when I was very, very young, our kitchen was had a single sink, of course, and we had an ice box. And yet the table at Christmas was laden with a turkey or with ham or with those and the accompanying ingredients, cranberry sauce, et cetera, that we still have today. And so the cooking, we had a coal stove to cook on, as I remember, and coal was everywhere, of course, in deep southern Illinois and in Heron, where I grew up. I was born in Carbondale. And the stove put out a lot of heat. The children had to stay away from it, of course, but my mother did wonders on that stove. And those were my earliest memories of. You brought up the kitchen, and I'm thinking now of how spare it was compared to what it what we all seem to have today and take for granted.
Yeah. A friend of ours who lives down the street, her daughter asked me recently, why do we have so many oranges at Christmas time? And I said, because once upon a time, they were a great luxury.
Oh, yes. And in the early, at the turn of the century, any fruit during winter solstice, and you don't expect fruit. We didn't have the transportation that we have today that could bring fruit in from California or from Florida, although it's pretty cold in Florida this year, so the price of fruit's going up. But and then particularly during the Depression, fruit was not easily come by, even though it may have been available, it was expensive. But that fruit, oranges, and very practical gifts were what one remembered. Many of the memories in this book show the children's letters and so on, overcoats, boots, socks. These are things that they wanted, and oranges.
Mm. What was your favorite cookie as a kid?
Oh, I suppose just a rolled flour cookie. None of these, very few of these that are in the book are the cookies that I remember as a kid, but we didn't have a lot of, we didn't have sprinkles. We just had plain cookies, and if we could have peanut butter in them or a little bit of sugar, that that was good.
Yeah. Well, there are quite a few recipes in here, and they all look very, very good. And some of them are we would recognize, you know, we make these in our kitchens today, thumbprint cookies, for example. But there are also some things like larded grouse, which I found kind of interesting, and I thought, well, that's a good way to cook a tough old bird.
Right.
And but how did you tell us about putting together this portion of the book, which is really charming, Eating Merrily?
Oh, this part of the book, the book would not have been have come to fruition, I'm sure. But you were mentioning Laura Holman's essay or recipe for larded grouse, and just before that she has venison with sour cream. These are the old roasted wild duck. These are the hunters, the rather normal Southern Illinois fare, because you. You went hunting for your game, and it was a particular pleasure. You didn't really have to do that even in the 1940s when she was writing. But and by the way, she published through Dan Malkovich's Outdoor Illinois. Dan is, of course, the father of
John Malkovich.
John Malkovich,
yeah.
The actor in Benton, Illinois. But... These were hunters' recipes. Other recipes here are more what we can assemble from the store. They also, the recipes have a distinct as the Elizabeth Karras recipes of the Edward Karras Mansion in LaSalle indicate a very distinct historical meaning to those people who did the recipe. And we think of our mother's recipes. We usually think of Christmas. What did she make at Christmas? And sometimes, of course, fathers enter in, as they do in one of the recipe stories by Marjorie Abrith Snyder, Noisy Cookies and Pickled Herring, although I say pickled smelt herring, because... her German father couldn't get herring out of Lake Michigan. He got smelt and pickled them, called them herring. So there's just a special family history associated with these recipes. And Dixie Terry from Goreville, Illinois, deep, deep Southern Illinois, who continues to write recipes, any number of good Christmas recipes that she makes, and I haven't eaten any of them, but they're I can tell that they're good. I've been reading her columns in Spring House for many, many years.
Yeah. So, well, also these recipes reflect our great diversity. You mentioned pickled herring, only it's pickled smelt. But there's also pfeffernusse, pfeffernusse recipe in here. And I grew up in Rockford, where there's quite a big Italian population of people of Italian descent. And I recall most fondly these delicate cookies that, they're kind of a short pastry.
Yes, I know the pastry you're talking about. I don't think I have any in the book.
Yeah, no, but I finally found a recipe for these, and they contain figs, and they're just, it's fig and orange zest and orange juice, and that is just like out of this world. I thought after my first Italian Christmas cookie like that, I thought, those Fig Newtons are... They're just not doing it for me anymore. So, spoiled me. Well, before we go, I mentioned in my introduction, I mentioned Mike Royko, and you include a piece that he did that, I don't know if it's still printed at Christmas time in the Tribune, but it was reprinted for many, many years. Tell us about Mary and Joe, Chicago style.
Well, this piece by Mike Rico has indeed become a classic, but it's a take on you know, it's almost the question if Jesus could come again, how would we greet him?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story about not just Jesus, but Mary and Joseph, transients coming into Chicago. And in Mike Royko's ironic style, he talks about Mary being separated from Joseph. She's in a representative of the Planned Parenthood Committee, comes to give her a lecture on birth control. This is Mike Rocco humor, of course, and Joseph is hauled off to the sanctuary, and Jesus is placed in the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. Joe is sent to Chicago State Mental Hospital. And it's very, very confusing, of course, to them, how they're going to exist with all this bureaucracy around them. And eventually, Joe gets three tickets and gets on a bus heading for Southern Illinois, the area known as Little Egypt. Mm. And just as the bus pulls out, three strangely dressed men run into the station, but they were too late. It was gone. So they started hiking down U.S. 66, but at last report, they were pinched on suspicion of being foreigners in illegal possession of gold.
Mm.
And I think that story, I hate to end on that because this is, but it gives us Mike Royko's distinctly, he's really talking about Chicago and how indifferent bureaucracy can be.
I don't think we'll end on that, but I think it's a good place. I think it's good to talk about because, you know, it's like, hey, what are we doing here? Let's take a minute and think about what this time of year really is all about.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mary and Joe Chicago style.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so wonderful to hear Royko's voice come off the page again. And I'll just read the first paragraph.
Okay, good.
Mary and Joe were flat broke when they got off the bus in Chicago. They didn't know anybody, and she was expecting a baby. And it is so Mike Royko.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was such a wonderful journalist and won the Pulitzer Prize and... penned that, I believe, in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So do you have a favorite piece in the book to end us up on a high note?
Oh, gosh. a favorite piece, one of my favorite pieces is Belinda Gray in the Christmas Carol, a carol that was sung, a folk song in 19, well, it actually came out of the Carolinas, but that one is a little bit too dark, perhaps. So let me just, I knew you were going to ask me for a favorite piece, so let me just read a couple of letters.
Oh, okay.
From the kids.
Okay.
And this is 1909. Vermilion County, which does keep a lot of its historical records, by the way, of Christmas. And it was a gold mine for me to use in this book. Dear Santa, I would like a football and a game of fish pond, a bugle horn, and a drum. If it's not too much, bring a tool chest, a little ship, some nuts and oranges. Goodwin Maxfield. Or, Dear Santa, I am 7 years old, I wish you would bring me a doll with pretty black hair and some doll clothes and bed and dresser. This is all, for you have so many to give to. Only don't forget my cousin Goldie. She is bad sick.
Mm.
So these letters are just great, and I follow them with a letter from Robert Greene Ingersoll, the agnostic, what he wants for Christmas. And he ends it, I would like to see the whole world free, free from injustice, free from superstition. This will do for next Christmas. The following Christmas, I may want more.
Mm. Now, there's a lovely place to leave it.
Right.
James Ballou, thank you very much for talking with me this morning.
Thank you, Celeste, for having me.
James Ballou is the editor of Christmas in Illinois, a collection of holiday memories, recipes, and images. The book is published by the University of Illinois Press.